Welcome to Changing the Narrative with Dina Eccles. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the founding of this nation, there are some who speculate on its demise. I've always held that the words, "all men are created equal," was an evolutionary step for humankind. Being a white child of the empire afforded me, to some extent, the illusion of our superiority. But as I read the words of Black authors like Baldwin, Lord, and Morrison, and spent decades learning from a Diné mentor, the startling histories of racism and hatred informed me. This project of creating a republic born on high ideals, but by flawed and mortal men, is far from over. For these reasons, I'm very grateful to have been invited to read The Great Contradiction, The Tragic Side of the American Founding by Joseph J. Ellis. A renowned historian, Ellis was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers, the Revolutionary Generation, and won a National Book Award for American Sphinx, the character of Thomas Jefferson. And I'm delighted to explore his extensive research in The Great Contradiction with him now. Well, let's just jump right into it about the two failures,
Okay.
as you see it, the two failures: no justice towards Native Americans and not stopping slavery.
Yeah, well, the way I'd frame it is I begin with a quote from my favorite writer of fiction, F. Scott Fitzgerald. Actually, two quotes, they cut one of them. First quote was, "Show me a hero and I'll write you a tragedy." The second is, "The mark of a truly intelligent person is the ability to hold two contradictory ideas in his or her mind and still function." And that is exactly the posture that I say we should have towards the American Revolution. What do I mean? I could go on this first. The first half is the American Revolution, the successful war to win the war against Great Britain, on some people's mind, was a miracle. How could 13 colonies come together? They'd never worked together before to defeat the dominant military and economic power in the world. And the founding generation, they're all, as you said, imperfect human beings. But it's interesting. Newly arrived world power seemed to need to create fictional heroes. Rome had Romulus and Remus. Great Britain had King Arthur. Who had, well, anyway, there's a need to believe that the people who are the founders of an emerging powerhouse are themselves some demigods. Well, the bulk of my work over 40 years in trying to understand that generation is to say, no, they're all imperfect human beings. But that, on the one hand, this is an extraordinary achievement. And it reverses the tectonic plates of Western political thought. It changes it from the power doesn't flow downward from God to kings, but upward from the elected representatives, from the people to their elected representatives. That's a huge transition,
right?
and eventually shapes all Western political thought. So, boy, yeah, these guys were really great. They did something really wonderful and or really incredible. On the other hand, they failed to end slavery in all the states south of the Chesapeake. And they did end it, we can talk about that, in most of the northern states. And they failed to reach a just accommodation with the Native Americans. They failed to avoid Indian removal.
Wow.
Jefferson went back to Virginia and told the rest of Virginians, there's a traitor in our midst. Mount Vernon is a Trojan horse.
Wow.
And Jefferson, I mean, excuse me, Jefferson is like the Mona Lisa of American history, in the sense he wrote the most important words in American history, the ones that you referred to that begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." On the other hand, he didn't free his slaves. And he believed that any kind of biracial society would infect the purity of the Anglo-Saxon race. So It's what happens when you end slavery to the freed slaves. Not just can we end slavery, but if we do, are we willing to embrace the idea of a biracial society? And the answer in both sections, North as well as South, is no. No. The majority of the white population in both regions finds that incomprehensible. And it's an interpretation that has contemporary implications,
Yeah, clearly. That, yeah.
clearly. I show my political colors here a little bit, that my own best judgment, with some evidence, is that approximately 30% of the white population in the United States does not believe that we should be a multiracial society. We are.
Yeah.
Guess what? We are the most multiracial society in the world.
Right.
Now, well, I'm all right. Just to, over the overview of the book is to say that the American Revolution failed in, it won in several major ways. By the way, to take it off on the side, Washington himself said at the end of the war, when he was asked who should write a history of the war, said, anybody who writes a true history of this war will be accused of writing fiction. And so it looks like a miracle that we won. Here's the real truth. We didn't have to win. The British had to win. And the British Army was not big enough to maintain control over a population on a continent. They could do something easily with the Scots or with the Irish, but you're dealing with a fundamentally, and I think, I think, who was it? The later writer, Common Sense, said, can an island rule a continent? No. So that two things, on the one hand, it looks like a miracle that we won the war. On the other hand, the British had no chance over time. And so Ellis is again asking you to be capable of irony and to recognize that these men are the greatest leaders in American history. None of them, as far as I could tell, spoke directly to God. And I like Adams most because he's the most honest. He tells you what he's really thinking.
Speaking
And
of it,
he's married to the most interesting woman of the era
I
named
was just
Madeline.
going to go to that. I was just
Okay.
going to say that was the other interesting flaw, maybe, that Abigail took on. I thought that
Oh
was a beautiful
yeah.
way.
She writes a letter to him in April of 1776, just before the Declaration of Independence. And it begins, by the way, I tell my students, you ever get a letter that begins, by the way, look out, baby, it's coming at you, okay? And the by the way was the very argument you're making against the British government and British Parliament has implications for women. And they're clear. And she's not just saying that women should have the vote. She's saying that male supremacy is incompatible with the values we claim we're fighting for in the Declaration. And guess what? She's right. But the values of not just of racial equality, but of gender equality are embedded in the American promise. If you, one way to put it is, the American Revolution over?
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's
And
not. It's
that's what
not.
I believe. Like, we're still in this creative process. But one of the sentences or phrases that you used was the avoidance strategy. And I found it fascinating watching as these men would meet over time, and how especially Madison was able to deflect what he knew was coming, and with avoidance, not taking it on. And it's like kick the can. And this is what we see now. It's the same thing happening. I mean, this is why, to me, your book is important, because if you can see the flaw, if you can see what happened at that time, and understandably, yes, the women couldn't, you can paint Abigail as somebody who was quite happy to be a housewife, but she clearly, in her written words, that may not be true.
Her husband said, "We need to preserve all our letters," and they do. It's the reason we know so much about them. There's 1,200 letters, and he said, "Because, but make sure you do it because your letters are better than mine." And guess what? He's right, and I'm not the only person that thinks that. They're more literate, they're more, references to Shakespeare, etc. But when I say she didn't become a feminist, but she always was an independent woman who was intellectually, like when Adams was president and he screwed up and she was still back in Boston, they'd all say, "Oh, she wasn't there to correct him."
And again, this is how I've always seen the Constitution as an evolutionary step. I think we're in another moment of that. We're in a moment where we can't avoid the avoidance. We can't keep doing the avoidance strategy. Not, so when you say women are coming out as gangbusters, well, there's the other reality that because of the anti-DEI being given by patriarchs again, su white supremacists again, this is a more black women have been taken away from their jobs, particularly black women. So it's a really important, this is an important thing that you're highlighting, that you're showing in your book, because it has to stop, but you can't, if you keep believing the founding fathers, two capitals, founding fathers, if you keep deifying these people, as you point out, and not realize that they left unfinished business.
What you said about the failure of the founders is, in my judgment, essentially correct. However, if you wanted to end slavery, the only way to do it is to pass a constitution that gives the federal government the power to make foreign and domestic policy. The government in place after the revolution, called the Articles of Confederation, is the same form of government that the Confederacy adopted in 1861. The power resides in the states. And as long as that's true, all the southern states are going to refuse to end slavery. You can bet on that. Okay, so the only way to end it, and this is the second half of the American Revolution, it's 11 years later. We'll have to celebrate it 11 years from now. That's the creation of the Constitution. If you insisted in the debates in the Constitutional Convention that slavery had to end and it be on the agenda, it would have never passed. And it would certainly never have been ratified. That's the crisis, that's the political problem they faced, okay? And Madison is right part of that. And initially, what they come up with is, okay, we're not going to end slavery now, but we're going to end it in 1807, which is the year that the slave we can take on ending the slave trade. And that's what Washington believes they agreed on. But a few years later in the American Congress, Madison takes the lead to change that. Madison moves from being a great American to being a Virginian. He switches. And by the way, the only history of the Constitution that we have is the one kept by Madison. And we've learned fairly recently by a woman scholar at BC Law School that he changed what he wrote over the years, that it's not a reliable index of what was said at the Constitution. And we'll never know what was said because most of their conversations about this kind of stuff occurred in restaurants and hotels, and they prohibited any record of it being formally kept. Anyway,
Much
my
like
mark.
today.
Yeah, well, yeah, and but that Madison in eight in 1790, basically 1791 too, says that the law now says that states control the decision on slavery, and the federal government has no power to do that. And once you said that, boy, again, the Civil War you could hear in your ears. And Madison, that's where Madison fails. I think that among the founders, the ones that look better to me after writing the book, and I've been studying them for 40 years, Washington looks a lot better. Hamilton looks like the smartest. He would have got the highest scores on the SATs because he has an idea that nobody else has, including Washington. Washington, when with Tom comes to, this is not in the book too much, but maybe it is, but it's not much. Washington said, "We can't have a constitutional convention because the bulk of the American people, by far, don't want one. Their orientation is local. They think locally." And Hamilton says, "That's the reason we need a constitution. We need to create a federal government with power, and eventually move them over time to a recognition that they have to surrender their local identities." And at any rate, Madison comes out looking, I mean, excuse me, Hamilton looks pretty good. Jefferson doesn't look so good. Madison doesn't look so good. There is another guy who I like to put in my list that nobody else puts in their list of great founders. His name is John Jay. If I said that Hamilton is the smartest, Jay is the most competent in a very slow, behind the scenes way often. I mean, we would have never gotten the treaty we got with France, with Great Britain. He insisted the western borders was the Mississippi. Before that, it was going to be Ohio. And he said, when Washington was elected president and he knew he had to appoint a cabinet, the first person he asked, he said, "I'll give you any position you want in the cabinet," was Jay. Jay said, "I don't want to be in the cabinet. I want to be chief justice," which he was.
But yeah, I do want to keep pointing out the things that I learned in your book that were very important to me as far as how we are now. And it's when you started bringing in the abolitionists and the Quakers, and when their voice started to be heard, and how they were treated, because it's exactly the same thing now. It's like there's an evolution of ideas, which are very brilliant ideas that created this construct that now we are, some might say, suffering under. And these voices of morality, these voices of consciousness, were
The
just
Quakers led the
ignored.
way. The Quakers led the way, but the other, especially people that went to religious revivals, they call them the New Faith or the old, and there was very little political opposition to slavery, but that there was enormous opposition from religious groups. They were prepared to make it a moral issue, and they were. And they succeeded in the northern states, at least to some extent. That is, they say they're only going to remove criminals. Immigrants only perform about, only are guilty of about less than 2% of the criminal action in the United States. And the people that are vulnerable are people that are black or brown. Lincoln said the following. I don't have it written in front of me, but I'll give it to you as close as possible.
Fine.
Okay. This is in right after the Gettysburg Address. "All honor to Jefferson for the man who, in the concrete pressure of, I love this, merely revolutionary moment," he must have been smiling when he wrote that, "had the courage and the forecast to implant an absolute truth and to leave it there. So it will be a harbinger against injustice and tyranny in the future. What he was saying is that the Declaration, the magic words of the Declaration, the most important words in American history, and I would say in world history, were not designed to be totally operative at the moment.
Right.
They were designed to set a standard. It's a very optimistic standard, and in some ways it borrows from the values of the Enlightenment, Jefferson did. And so some of my friends would say, you know, since Freud, none of that really makes much sense. Human beings aren't that put together to be kind to each other. If you have two candidates and one wants to tell you who to hate and the other wants to tell you who to love, the first one will always win.
This moment,
At this moment,
this
yeah.
moment, I want to keep encouraging us to realize that what you just said, that Lincoln said, that it's a standard that we're still trying to achieve. And I really, I keep maybe I'm talking to Grace Lee Boggs, who's no longer with us, but I, you know, and I, the next American Revolution, her book, and the voices of the marginalized people that have lived through and been successful in their communities and their and see it differently, you know, understand government differently, understand community differently. I think this is the moment we're at, that the tired eye ideas that we have held up as truths. And I'm not talking about the truths. I'm talking about the ones that say, you know, white people won't want to work in the farm, you know, blah, blah, all this stuff, all of the racial things that have allowed us to do horrible things are coming to an end. And they're being, it's where this is a moment where we don't really have a choice, because everything that the founding fathers, little f's, founding fathers, wanted to see happen will not be able to happen in the ways they did it. It's
I want to
going to have to
just
change.
a slight correction or amendment to your, some of the founders, but not all of them. It depends on which founder at what time. Washington looks pretty good, as I said. Jefferson doesn't look so good. Jefferson basically said, slavery's wrong, horrible, it's very bad. However, once freed, blacks cannot remain in the same area.
That
And
was
that,
tough reading.
And that, now here's the thing. He said, if they enter, if they stay, they'll intermarry and that'll corrupt the Anglo-Saxon race. Without Jefferson, American history doesn't make any sense.
No, I agree with you. It's a paradox.
It is a paradox.
It is.
That's what my advisors at Yale always said. You always look for paradox.
Brilliant
And I
mind.
guess I
Brilliant
do.
mind.
I mean, the founders as a group got us in the position that we could be an independent nation and eventually have to face it. And we tried, we faced it once in the Civil War and we ended slavery. Bloodiest war in American history. The Civil Rights Movement, and then, you know, but you can see an attempt, every time you move forward, there's an attempt to push against it. And there is a group of Americans who will consistently oppose what appears to be the inevitable. And the reason they're so upset is they know it's inevitable.
Understood and agreed. And I, again, I'm going to always lean towards consciousness over the constructive, you know, because the ideas came and there could be new ideas for new constructs of government. Getting rid of the Electoral College would definitely help. But, you know, sometimes working outside of the system, and I think a lot of people are right now.
During the American Revolution, the Continental Army was racially integrated.
Right, I read that.
And racially means they actually served in combat units. The British Army was racially integrated, but they wouldn't let them serve in combat units. They could pull, dig trenches and do that kind of thing. And the officers in the British Army wouldn't serve with blacks. But in the American Army, there were about 100 blacks serving alongside the Americans at Bunker Hill. There were over 1,000 in the last battle in the war, Yorktown. Over the course of the war, the best estimate, and it's hard to get this because you want to, what do you count, militia people or not, about 7,000 served. And the leading combat unit in the Continental Army, the one that Washington always picked for dangerous missions, was predominantly black. The next time the United States has a racially integrated military is not until the Korean War. There are obviously many blacks served during World War I and World War II, but they did not serve, they served in segregated units. And so we have only very recently, in the middle of the 20th century, approached the same standard that we originally had in 1776.
Yeah, and again, you bring out a lot of these really important understandings, historical facts. And I really appreciated your t the tablets that you have in there, the first census, how it was broken down. And it was interesting to see the free blacks versus,
They it says they had the categories, whites, blacks, other, the other are free blacks. And so you've got a good idea what the demography is in the in 1790. And again, when it's all taken, I'm going to go back to where we started. Who, I think it was a 19th century theologian said, they saw God face to face. We could only see him secondhand. That didn't mean they were divine. It just meant they happened to become alive and reached maturity during a great crisis. And they were forced to take a position in that crisis, and the majority of them went with independence. And there's a moment after, in July 2nd, the Virginia delegation proposes, these colonies are and have every right to be independent states. Many of the people said that was the vote, that was the key vote, and it was July 2nd. They had to be all in before they knew what cards they held. And so if there hadn't been a war, Washington would have just been some sort of, southern farmer. Jefferson, we know about maybe his architecture or something like that. But that's what made them. Otherwise, and Adams would just be a sort of country lawyer. And but they did rise to that occasion. They won the war, and they lost a portion of the peace.
And my hope would be that in this moment, there are those people, and it just won't be white men, who
Right.
are stepping up to this moment, because there are a lot of people who would be very happy to just keep living their lives, their comfortable lives, without looking around at what's happening to their neighbors, without looking what's happening possibly soon to be in Iran, what just happened in Venezuela, the poor people suffering in Cuba because of our militarism. There have to be this same awakening now. And again, it's why I appreciated reading your book, seeing how the people had to interact with one another, at least what we know. The thing that I always have to feel, because education becomes a another stick we use against one another, but there is that the literacy of the heart. And because there were a lot of people in our histories who were not educated but were brilliant,
Yeah, well,
and
that's right.
you
I
know
mean,
so
Washington had no education.
right, see, case in
Yeah,
point.
well, actually, I
So
mean, what Adams did, Jefferson did, Madison did, Hamilton did.
Abigail did.
Well, Abigail had not a formal education, but she was extremely well read. And but the greatest leader of them all, Washington, had no education, no formal education.
I
His
love that.
education was war. It brought to
I
war.
love that we have that understanding as, but we have to kind of come to an end here. Although I'm sure that you and I could go on talking quite a bit. There's a lot, again, a lot in this book. I encourage people to read it. All right, so we have our work cut out for us.
We do.
We're in the next revolution.
We are, well, we're completing the first, okay? Can you give me that one? All right.
You say
We need to
tomato, I'll
complete
say
the first
tomato.
revolution. The founders are looking down saying, get it done, baby. Get it done.
All right. I like that. That's a good way. But I'm going to close out now and let people know that you've been listening to a conversation with Joseph Ellis on his new book, The Great Contradiction: The Tragic Side of the American Founding. It offers important recognition of the duplicity of the creation of the nation that declared all men are created equal, but could find no justice for indigenous people and no end to slavery. For this, the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding, it presents an important reckoning on the contradictions which still haunt us. I'm Dina Eccles, and this has been Changing the Narrative. Special thanks to WDRT Studios and to you, our listeners. Be well, and may we finally change course.